Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Canucks playoff coverage on Sportsnet 650 is brought to you by All Seasons Roofing. Sun, rain, wind, or snow, All Seasons Roofing has you covered with end-to-end roofing services. For your free quote, visit allseasonsroofing.ca. Now joining us on the phone, he's a part of Sportsnet's NHL coverage and, of course, a former NHL scout, our pal, Jason Bukala. Jason, are you still in Finland?
Jamie, I'm back, my friend. I've returned from the great white north. It was a great trip, and you know, I took the advice of two of my favorite colleagues in Vancouver and golfed in the long drink there just to make sure that you guys weren't full of it. And it was definitely well worth it. Let me tell you, well worth it.
That was gonna be my first question off the hop was, do you have a long drink review for us? So thank you for getting to it right away. Okay, we'll move on to the Stanley Cup playoffs here at some point. But I mean, you know, I have to ask you about what you saw from Canadian player Gavin McKenna, not draft eligible for another 2 years, already playing and thriving and dominating at this tournament.
Yeah, he was. He still is producing at a high clip. 15 points in 5 games over there. You know, one of the top 2 scorers in the tournament, James Higgins, who's an underage as well for Team USA, but he's eligible for next year's draft, where McKenna is 2 years down the road, and that's incredible when I watch him play, because a year ago, I watched Celebrini come to Switzerland and you know, be one of Team Canada's best players at that event as an underage. Thinking McKenna's got 2 years. I mean, play driver. Over there, the bigger ice, the wider ice sheet really agrees with him even more. When he got the edge, he would literally just zip by 2 or 3 checks down the lane. And guys like that, they attract chaos, right? Especially in, you know, when you're in a tournament like this, the U18s, those kids are still maturing on how to play with detail and consistent detail, and so they chase him down, right? And that opens up other people around the ice, and people around him were benefiting from the fact that he was attracting so much attention. But he's the next one, I have to say. I mean, Bedard came through, obviously, and McKenna's on the horizon in 2 years, which is incredible. But even in this draft class right now, given what I've seen, like, he would be a top 15 pick in this draft, probably top 10 or better, to be honest. And that's saying something.
Books, can you talk about the deceptiveness of his skating and what you've seen on that front?
It's incredible. So what's interesting about him when you scout him is, he's not one of those guys that I think deception is the very best way to put it. He's not one of those guys that exposes himself, that he's going full tilt right away. You know what I mean? He doesn't get in a deep knee bend, and you can see he's emptying the tank between the blue lines right away. He's got this kind of, I don't want to call it a straight up stride, but a mid-range type of stance. And all of a sudden, he just explodes to open space, literally explodes, guys. It's a special talent that he has. You know the way the game's played nowadays, right? It's a track meet for the most part, and these skill guys are getting harder and harder to check, and put him right in that category, because his elusiveness is it's something to behold. It's fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's wild to think that he's
got... So,
go ahead, Dretz.
When I met Gavin up in Kelowna a couple weeks back, I was chatting with him at length, Books, and growing up in the Yukon, as he did, he had an outdoor rink in his backyard, but it was available like 9 months of the year, right? Like all year he had ice. And you talk to people about his game and just the deceptiveness of how he skates. Like, I've heard people say that he's got a chance to be like hockey Barry Sanders, in that he just moves differently than everyone else. It kind of tracks with all those reps, like the natural advantage that comes with growing up on the ice effectively.
Yeah, I can totally see it. I think that's a cool analogy, actually, Barry Sanders, because every time anybody who watched Barry Sanders were lucky enough to watch Barry Sanders run the ball for the Detroit Lions back in the day, every time they, you know, you think he was going to get hit, he wasn't, right? He was always slipping off people and exposing holes. And McKenna's the exact same way, guys. Like he can operate from the flank, obviously pick people apart from the perimeter, but he has an interior game too with a quick stick and really small areas where he sees plays that other people don't see. Like when you're contested in traffic areas and you can make a quick play to somebody who's not necessarily expecting it, but oh, all of a sudden the puck's on his stick and the puck's in the back of the net, hopefully. People around him benefit from that. So he's one of those play drivers that when you're lucky enough to play on his line, you better be aware the whole time. Never sleep on your shift because the puck might end up on your stick.
Hopefully Gavin McKenna goes to a team that has a little bit more success than the Lions did with Barry Sanders, and he doesn't have to walk away from the game at age 30 like Barry Sanders. That would be nice to see. Before we get into the Stanley Cup playoffs, in terms of draft eligibles this year, who caught your eye over in Finland at the tournament?
There's a riser on Team USA that I took a shine to, call it November-ish, and then really in February at the Five Nations tournament. His name's Teddy Stiga. He's the second leading scorer on Team USA right now, and he's got 10 points through his first five games. It is a little bit misleading, I have to say, the point production too, because without Russia at this tournament or the Belarusians, like, you know, the pool is watered down a little bit on the back end of the tournament. But having said that, you don't pick your opponent, you just play the game. So this guy here is Nils Hollander-like, but even, you know how Nils is scoring goals at even strength, and, you know, he might project to be on the power play. Stiga's a different level up from that, so he makes more plays. Like, he distributes more than him. He's built kind of like Hollander. He's kind of built like a fire hydrant, really quick to space. But his compete level is off the charts. I love that about him. Not only is he scoring, he's killing penalties. He's going to compete in the full 200 feet, and he would really impress me. Now, we can't get off this call without talking about Teej Aginla. We have to throw it out there. I had a really cool conversation with him in the concourse one day, and, you know, he comes right over at the end of the Kelowna series, and, you know, he's a little gassed, to be honest with you, you know, because he came late. His tournament's been okay, I would say, by his standard. I think there'd be another level, but I have to put it in perspective a bit. This kid, though, fellas, like his momentum and the way he's playing the game and tracking back and not only just ripping pucks, but extending plays. And then, of course, tracking back to kill plays, like defensively on top of everything else. It's an evolution to watch. And I think his trust, like people already like them. I think they're going to love him more now because they know they can trust him in all a bunch of different scenarios. I don't know if he's going to kill penalties in the NHL, but I'm telling you, he's got the brain and the effort to do it.
All right, so on to the, and I'm glad you got the Aginla commentary in there. I know Drant's a huge fan of the player. On to the Stanley Cup playoffs, the Canucks and the Preds. And, you know, a big talking point here has been the Canucks' struggles to get shots on goal against UC Saros. Despite leading the series 3-2, they're in the record books in a lot of ways for fewest shots at different points in a series. What are you seeing that either Nashville is doing, that the Canucks aren't doing, that is preventing the Canucks from getting more shots on net in this series?
Well, Nashville's proficient at Nashville can't track with the Canucks. When the Canucks are going the way the Canucks can go, Nashville can't track with the Canucks at full speed the entire 60 minutes. Like, it's not going to, they don't have the depth to do that. They have the effort to do it. Okay. They got their, you know, they're emptying the tank with what they have on that roster. And I think that some would even suggest that the Preds are probably punching above their pay grade a little bit overall for quite a period of time now. But having said all that, I really just want to simplify things as much as possible. So I don't have this elite scientific answer for you, but what I do have is that I just think we all have to move our feet a little bit more all the time. Like, and if there's nothing there to get, you know, direct the puck directly on net, I've seen a lot of this slap pass stuff going on. I don't know if you guys are noticing the same thing, but we're trying to get pretty cute, like guys coming through the slot, slap pass, or, you know, off the flank, slap pass. You know, let's just simplify things. You know, if it's a chip into an area, we keep our pace moving forward. Let's work a quick two-man cycle and then draw it off the wall and get it to the net as quickly as we can. What I'm trying to tell you is let's not let the Predators get set between the hash marks, because as soon as they get set as a unit down low and they start to collapse, they're really proficient at taking away shooting lanes. And if we can get to Saros, you know, he's an athletic butterfly goalie, real good goalie. We all know that. But, you know, there's some rebounds to be had there. And, you know, the more you're in motion and there's rebounds to contest versus an opponent who's looking for a puck bound off a goaltender, that makes your life a little bit easier. So I mean, we can't sugarcoat it, though, guys. Like, Elias Pettersson's got 7 shots on goal and 2 assists in 5 games played. So, you know, he's our star player, right? Or one of our star players, pardon me. And we need him to get going and find a way. And I think a lot with him, too, is just exactly that. Let's get moving our feet much more consistently.
Where's your confidence level in the Canucks closing this out tonight or on Sunday, Books? I mean, from the sounds of it, it seems like you're pretty confident that Vancouver is the significantly better team.
Yeah, I'm still confident about this. One thing that I believed in the Canucks, let me draw a comparison for you. Like, the Toronto Maple Leafs, for example, have been chasing this this notion that they're a contending team for several years now. You know what I mean? And there was always this, the hiccup with me was process and identifying what they were as a team. And where the Canucks have been forever, since they earned my trust, call it in November even, is that their process has stayed or remained, for the most part, it's 82 games. We all know we have some ebbs and flows. We talked about that on the show. But, you know, for the most part, they've continued on with their process, and they identify as a certain type of team that's going to just continue on being us, and it's going to, you know, come to fruition, if you will. I still trust that process into the next 2 games. I still, you know, 18 shots per game, obviously it's an anomaly. But across the league, guys, the shots on goal are way down. You know, it's not just this series. It's a lot of series. There's a lot of sacrifice going on. This is just part of our process, if I'm a Vancouver Canuck right now, and just see it through. Just keep plugging away. Trust, you know, what your coach is preaching, and they have all year. And I'm okay with this. This the first round is the hardest one. And if we can get through this as a team, then, you know, I like our chances going to the second round to have at least taken away a positive out of this one with some resistance. And let's reload for the second round, which will be obviously much harder.
If the Canucks are able to get to the second round, how do you view the challenge that the Edmonton Oilers pose?
Well, different. You know, obviously they're gonna have the Canucks on their heels more defensively because of they have more depth, they have more quick strike than, you know, arguably any team in the league. I would probably put Colorado on that in that version too, especially at the top of the lineup with the pace that they play. But, you know, I think that there's going to be some question marks. We've got time on our side here. I see Demko skated today. I believe you guys might know, have an update on this, but it looks like maybe DeSmith tonight, who played very well, and then, you know, bad things happen there. So I just think that depending on where the goaltending's at, that's going to be item A on the agenda. I think they're going to get more chances to score goals against the Edmonton Oilers. The Edmonton Oilers will have more or less, pardon me, structure in hard areas and high danger areas than the Nashville Predators. And certainly teams like, you know, even the Dallas Stars for that matter. So it'll be different. They'll have to defend on their heels, but there's going to be more quick strike, like turning plays back up ice and more opportunities off the rush against a team like Edmonton. That's my belief. Time will tell. Let's hopefully get there and readdress the situation.
So it does sound like it's going to be Shelov's, actually. It was interesting because yesterday the rumblings were coming out that it would be DeSmith, but Shelov's at least first off the ice at morning skate, and, you know, based on Drance's interpretation, he was there. All signs pointing towards Shelov's, which is interesting. And, you know, I know it can be hard to break down goalie performance sometimes, but what have you seen from Shelov's in the couple of games that he started that you think has convinced Tocchet to go back to him for game 6?
Well, let's give him credit for being strong between the years. First of all, I don't think this guy woke up 2 weeks ago thinking he was going to be playing in Nashville tonight on Friday night in downtown Nash Vegas. The place will just be... Is Drancer there? Did I hear that right there?
He's in Nashville. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. The Friday night game, playoff game in Nashville on a Friday night, I can only imagine. But anyways, his mental...
Canucks are staying overnight too, so lots of incentive to win.
Oh, jeez. Just more incentive to win. That's outstanding. Good for you. Jealous, but at the same time, at my age, it'll take the next Tuesday for me to recover after that victory. So I gotta pace myself. But anyway, I appreciate Silov's makeup between the years. You know, one thing I have noticed too is that the group is really trusting him, and or at least putting on the best act that they trust him a great deal. And I think they do. You know, I saw that they were joking around in practice about him. From last year to this year, guys, if you watch Silov's play in the American League, and when he had a short, you know, a cup of coffee in the National Hockey League, his game is rounding into form much more now. Like, he is way less active in the net than he was when he first came over here. He's not as he's not tracking outside the post. He's not, you know, giving up as many second chances. You know, good on the guy. You know, is he up for this challenge? I believe he is. You know, you just need enough, don't you? But it's gonna be interesting to see if the star players can elevate to make his job easier.
Yeah, star players, I think absolutely the name of the game for the Canucks. And, you know, we've seen Quinn Hughes's minutes reduced a little bit, which has been a little surprising, right? Maybe some speculation that he's dealing with something physical. But one guy who has stepped up, not considered a star player in terms of his usage, in terms of his performance, has been Nikita Zadorov. If you were scouting the Canucks, right, and trying to, okay, lock in on what's making Zadorov successful in this series, how do the Predators maybe try to counter a little of what he's doing, what would you be focusing on from Nikita Zadorov?
Well, first of all, I think it's been a perfect storm for Zadorov. And what I mean by that is that the Preds, they play fast, but not as fast as some other teams. And so he's been able to time the way that he plays the game appropriately. You know, he's had a physical presence, right? He kind of set the tone with that early in the series. And then obviously, you know, he's got, I think he's only got 8 shots on goal in the series, but he's got 2 goals and he's got an assist. He's contributing that way. It is interesting to see the ice time because he's tracked on average now over 20 minutes in the series, where Hughes has come down literally about 5 or 6 minutes less than I believe game 2 or 3. So that is interesting, but it's a good news story. So he's asserted himself physically, and he's got 22 hits, I believe, total. And he's being efficient with the puck. When things get too quick and he gets standing still too often is when he can be exposed. But I'm really happy with his play. I think this has been the best version of himself and exactly what the Canucks had kind of hoped for when they acquired the player.
Books, just thinking about what we've seen around the league, are there any trends from the first round that stick out to you or have sort of recast your thinking about whether it's the upcoming free agent class or where the game's going?
Well, yeah. Do we have an hour? Because I could talk about Pierre-Luc Dubois until I'm blue in the face. One of my colleagues, you know, Rory Boylan, my colleague at Sportsnet, you know, Dancer and Jamie, that, you know, he wrote an interesting column today. And you know, we kind of went back and forth. He picked my brain on a few different things. Isn't that a fascinating situation, right? I don't know where Pierre-Luc Dubois became, you know, the next superstar in the league. I don't know when that happened, except maybe in the bubble in playoffs a few years ago. But outside of that, it's been relatively inconsistent. A lot of hype, not enough delivery. So that one's interesting to me because what are the LA Kings going to do with that contract? He's got a full no move that kicks in the summertime. On top of that, he's turning 26 at the end of June. So the first buyout window for him to be punted down the road at a lesser cost, 1/3 instead of 2/3 over a period of time. There's a lot of noise there, and I think he deserves to have that noise. He was awful, guys, awful for LA. He's on the fourth line at the end, and that's not good enough. I'm interested to see what happens in the Florida Panthers, you know, with their UFAs. I mean, you know, they're not really going to talk about it now, but Reinhart, he's going to get paid. And if I'm Sam Reinhart, I take a long, hard look at Jonathan Huberdeau going to Calgary, although that was a trade and then a sign. But when you get away from Alexander Barkov, guys, it's interesting to see how the player who was riding shotgun with what I think is one of the most elite centermen in the league, it's interesting to see how their stats fall off somewhere else because they don't get as many pucks the way that Barkey gets pucks to a guy like Reinhart. And then, you know what, I got to say, coming off the Boston and Leaf game last night that I broke down, you know, if we're going to throw rocks at glass houses, call it Mitch Marner or whoever, even Elias Pettersson, like David Pastrnak was invisible the last 2 games in elimination games. And this is a trend the last 2 years in Boston. They have had a hard time closing out series, obviously. And there's another star player that needs to elevate tomorrow night. He's got no choice, right, to be better. So there's a lot. There's a lot of noise. LA goaltending is another one. Where are they going with that? So I got a lot of thoughts. And then we're not even talking about the coaches yet. The coaching carousel is going to be fascinating.
The coaching carousel is an interesting one. Reardon, sort of the most recent, it's an associate coach turfed out in Pittsburgh. What was the coaching change that surprised you the most? Which team has made a move, whether it's, you know, Lindy in Buffalo, so a hiring or a decision to fire a coach, maybe like a Hackstall? Which is the situation that's most surprised you?
I would have to say the Lindy hiring in Buffalo, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, Lindy Ruff's had a phenomenal career. Like, he's been, you know, he's been good for the NHL for as long as I can remember, to be perfectly honest, back to his playing days, whether it be, you know, with Sabres, Rangers, doesn't matter. And then obviously that huge run with the Sabres back his first time around as a head coach. Before that, he was an assistant coach in Florida when they went to the Stanley Cup way back in the 90s. So I would say that one there. There was this time where it felt like, in most recent memory, there was a lot of these like progressive type of hirings. You know, it seemed to be the word of the day, a progressive hiring. And then, you know, European coaches were even on the radar. But the Buffalo Sabres absolutely need to be a playoff team. You know, I've been saying that for I don't know how many years now. They got to get this right. It's kind of getting nauseating, to be honest with you. I just don't know that Lindy Ruff is the guy. I hope he is. You know, I hope for Lindy. I hope for the franchise. But that one was curious, just given, you know, where Lindy is in his cycle for his career. Hackstall, you know, I that one didn't surprise me as much. I think that a coach like that, like, there were a lot of nights this year, guys. Seattle was tough to watch, eh? Like, offensively. And I just think that a coach like that, you know, there's a shelf life for a coach that expects certain things out of his team. And it certainly looked like it kind of ran its course there. So that one there didn't surprise me as much. And honestly, if you can survive 3 years in the league anymore as a head coach with the same franchise, it seems like you're doing, like, I think I read something the other day, Marty St. Louis is like the sixth longest tenured coach in the league already, which is insane. That's insane.
I think Rick Tocchet's second in the Pacific Division in terms of his tenure, which is also absolutely mind-blowing. Just before we let you go, Books, Boston or Toronto, who gets it done on Saturday?
I picked Boston in seven. Before this all came down, I'm still sticking with Boston in seven.
All right. I picked Boston in seven as well. So it should be a good one on Saturday.
Sorry, boys. Toronto in seven. Only one of us can be right. Sucks for you guys.
Only one of us isn't going to survive the weekend in Nashville if the Canucks win tonight. So Jamie and I at least will. We're going to survive.
You're not kidding.
Yeah, I'm going to have a quiet night at home after the Canucks game, one way or another. All right, Books, thanks as always, man. We'll chat next week.
All right, fellas. Take care. Thanks for having me.
That is Sportsnet's Jason Vukula, former NHL scout as well, joining us on the show as he does weekly, weighing in on everything happening around the playoffs and the NHL with the coaching carousel. Books, not a Pierre-Luc Dubois fan, with some strong thoughts on the Pierre-Luc Dubois experience in L.A. All right, we got one final hour of the show coming up as we inch closer to puck drop in Nashville. Just 3 hours to go before the teams get going in Game 6 of this first-round playoff series. By the way, this hour of Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Get your keys to an all-star collection of Kubota products at one of their six locations across BC this spring. Visit DLEAMC.com. More Canucks talk on the other way. Dimitri is going to join us at 1:30, but we've got another open segment up next. So get your texts in, get your thoughts in ahead of Game 6 here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. By the way, just before we get back into the inbox here for some Canucks questions and comments ahead of Game 6, which gets going in just a few hours here, have you seen the roster that Canada is going to be sending to the World Championships, Drantzer? I know that tournament not always high on hockey fans' viewing priorities at this time of year, especially not when your team is still in the Stanley Cup playoffs, but Connor Bedard, Macklin Celebrini, Adam Fantilli, Owen Power on the blue line, Olin Zellweger, like a host of super, super high premium recent numbers.
You know your audience,
picks.
Eh?
I know you're a Zellweger guy.
Most people would get 20 names deep before mentioning Zellweger. You're like, I got to catch Drantz's attention here.
Yeah, exactly.
Olin Zellweger, though, on international ice, baby, like, bite my fist already. Come on, let's go.
Oh, boy, I knew you'd be into it. I knew you would be into it.
I love his game, man.
Yeah.
You know what else? I just, like, I hear he's got, like, 0% body fat and lives at the rink and is just, like, a complete killer in terms of habits and mentality. I think this could be a coming out party, too, for Macklin Celebrini. I think we've actually dramatically underhyped Macklin Celebrini. I think there was like fatigue after the much ballyhooed 2023 draft class, and I think it's caused people to, you know, like gloss over just how special Celebrini's season has been. Gloss over the fact that like he probably is at the level where he would have been the second overall pick in that 2023 draft class. Man, he's good. Like, he's just so, so good. And, you know, we've been a little bit spoiled, but it's actually pretty rare to have consecutive, like, consensus 1-0-A's who are, like, unquestioned as the process unfolds. Usually the guys at the top get over-scouted and poked holes at, and, like, hockey analysis and evaluation is a pretty negative enterprise just in general, right? People focus way too much on what players can't do as opposed to what they can, and that's just, like, a natural thing across the sport, like across the industry. But you can't poke holes in this kid. Like, he's got everything. He's got the carrying the puck through the neutral zone. He's got a one timer that's going to play at the right flank day one in the NHL on like a good NHL power play. And he's got the defense awareness. He's never on the wrong side of the puck. That they played him at BU, even though he was 17 in all the high leverage defensive situations. I mean, yeah, I won't be surprised. Like, oftentimes you bring these younger players, you know, Quinn Hughes went to the Worlds in his draft year, stuff like that, and was like mostly the 7th D, or like Lakarimäki for Team Sweden. Like, he's very clearly their 13th forward, you know? But like, there's a chance that Celebrini carves out a real role. The other thing I want to see is I want to see some McCann Bedard.
All right.
Just two insane wrist shots together, and McCann can, you know, do some defensive help, heavy lifting to help out Bedard. There's something about that combo in my mind's eye that I'm very confident will work.
Yeah, there's just a lot to be excited about that Canada roster. And hey, they could add a couple people too. We'll see here, depending on how the rest of the results of the first round go. And yeah, especially if you're a fan of some of the young talent coming out of this country right now, lots to be excited about for the World Championships. But we've got Game 6, of course, coming up tonight between the Canucks and the Nashville Predators. And this text comes in. Should Rick Tocchet be calling out his players like Jim Montgomery is in Boston? Of course, you mentioned David Pastrnak earlier in the show in terms of star players who have not brought their A game in this series. And Jim Montgomery pretty direct that they need more from David Pastrnak if they're going to finish off this series against the Toronto Maple Leafs. Now, my response would be, like, I don't think it's, you know, outlandish for Jim Montgomery to do that, to, yeah, call out pretty directly a star player in the media like that. I don't think there's necessarily anything inherently wrong with a head coach doing that. One, though, I mean, Jim Montgomery's team blew a 3-1 lead last year, and they're on the cusp of doing it again, right? So it's not as if he's unlocked the secret to, you know, getting the most out of his players in a playoff series and finding a way to get them over the hump and close out series here. The other thing I would say is that I would be so reluctant to second guess either way how Rick Tocchet chooses to either criticize or not criticize a player in the media, because Rick Tocchet's calling card, even more than the like incredible structural improvements he's made to this team's defensive game, you go back to when they hired Rick Tocchet, and the leading kind of bullet point in this is why we want the guy really came down to his ability to build and maintain relationships with players, like, to use kind of a non-hockey way of putting it, like his emotional intelligence, right? And so it's the kind of thing where Rick Tocchet has earned so much leeway and so much benefit of the doubt with how he handles his players, right? And again, it's not to say that he should never criticize them vocally in the media, but it's just that I trust Rick Tocchet a lot on how he's choosing to approach his guys, how he's choosing to manage relationships, and how he's trying to get the most out of them in crucial situations.
It's also not as if Rick Tocchet's been like a wilting violet about laying real talk down on his team. Guy seethes after losses sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think. You know, he said Pettersson needs to move his feet. Like, he's been critical of
yep.
the performances of some of his players throughout this series and his team throughout this series. You know, the thing about the way Rick Tocchet has been pointed in his commentary about how this team plays throughout his Canucks tenure, but especially this season, is like he calls out Dakota Joshua before the season and he gets the response, right? He calls out the team after that loss in Philly, basically calls them soft, goes off.
Yep.
And he gets the response, right? They lose one more game in regulation in the next month. The defining quality of Rick Tocchet's not he doesn't blast his players. He's not necessarily pat on the back guy. He's also not necessarily kick in the butt guy. He seems to be willing to do whatever is required to get a response, and he consistently has got one from this team. So, you know, if he doesn't think right now that calling people out is going to get him what he needs, like today, and I mentioned it at practice yesterday, like he thinks this team needs positive reinforcement.
Yeah,
I can tell you that right now, just because I've watched this guy operate all season. You know, it stands out to me when his tone is particularly supportive, in part because he is so no BS most of the time. And, you know, over the course of that power play practice, great skill, guys. Like, oh, awesome. And like, I'm watching it, I'm like, this isn't that awesome. I don't know. It's okay. Like, there's some good things happening. There's some not good things happening. There's some bobbles. There looks like there's some frustration. And then today, you know, I thought there was another moment where he's like, if you told us we'd have a chance to close this out in six, we would have taken that in a heartbeat. Right? The idea that, like, what are you there's no problem. This isn't a crisis. This is where we want to be. This is an accomplishment. You know, I think yep. that's been the tone. Now, does that change if they drop one? Does that change if they drop one and perform poorly? Like, I don't know. You know, that chapter is yet to be written here. But I do think over the last 48 hours anyway, I've been able to observe and notice that right now anyway, it does seem like Tocchet's in positive reinforcement mode. And I'm sure there's a calculated reason for that, because there appears to be a calculated reason for most of these prods or kicks or pats on the back as they go, and typically speaking, he's got the response he needs. I actually think that, you know, more than the defensive improvements, the headline item for why he's going to win the Jack Adams, but one of the things that I've been most impressed by, honestly, has been the way that every time he's seemed to push a button, it's seemed to have the desired effect. I think that's a big subplot of what's unfolded for the Canucks all year.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple other things here, and this text comes in. Coaches can be critical without damaging a player's confidence. There's a way to do it properly, and I think Tocchet is doing a great job at it. And to your point, it's not as if he's not up there pretending that Elias Pettersson is playing great, right? He's been very specific about things that he can do better, things he wants to see different from Elias Pettersson. So there is an element of criticism. It's not, he's not sugarcoating it necessarily, even though he's not, you know, what we would necessarily say calling a player out when he's up there. And then this text as well, calling out the players is not necessarily Tocchet's style. You run the risk of losing the room long term when you start doing that to players. It's no secret who needs to step up. Let the fans and critics call them out. You have to stand behind your players. And I think that hits on something important, which is that I think Tocchet's very aware of losing the kind of big outburst from a coach as a tool if you go to it too often, right? You can only play that card a certain number of times before it starts to fall on deaf ears, before it starts to really lose the kick that it would have if you're a little bit more sparing with it. And I think part of it is they're not, as Tocchet has repeated a lot, and even today, and we've said it on this show, you know, their backs aren't up against the wall, right? They're not in a must-win game. They're in really important games. They're in games you would absolutely love to win, but they're not in that situation where he has to play that kind of desperation card and really try to find a way to spark the team. Now, the question of if they lose tonight, if they don't play Canuck hockey, if it's a disappointing performance, how does he respond kind of publicly facing going into game seven? That's a fascinating question to me, because I think it's pretty hard to like do an about face from positive encouragement and, you know, positive feedback and all of that to really fire and brimstone stuff going into game seven. That strikes me as a pretty dicey proposition. But I think a lot of this comes from just Rick Tocchet realizing like you can't play that card constantly. You're going to, as the texture says, lose the room. It's going to lose its effectiveness in a hurry.
Well, let me frame a question for you, Jamie.
Please.
If you haven't changed your lineup to this point, right? And say things go poorly for the Canucks tonight, like not that they lose, but they lose by more than a goal. Okay. Can you change stuff for game seven, given the I'm confident in our approach posture that you've had for 2 weeks? Or does that inspire panic when you do it? Like, do you get to a point where having not changed things yet, it becomes a limiting factor?
I think it's a very fair question. I think it would be hard to change your lines going into game seven. Now, things can happen in game six that could just necessitate it, right? And I think it almost becomes...
Totally, that's a good point.
It becomes easier the worse they play tonight, you know what I mean? Like, because you can get to a certain point where just like, wow, this one guy was really bad. I can't leave him in that position, and everyone will just understand it because of what we see play out tonight, right? Like, that's a theoretical thing that could happen, because so much of what he's relied on is like, hey, I actually don't mind our process necessarily. I don't mind our tactics. We just need to execute better. If it spirals beyond that, it becomes easier to change your lineup. But I do think, especially considering the quick turnaround, right? Friday in Nashville, I think you mentioned they're going to travel tomorrow either way. So you're not getting on the ice tomorrow. And then you've got a game day skate on Sunday. It's not a lot of time to get people acclimated to it. I think unless things really go off the rails tonight, you're probably locked into rolling the same thing back out there in game seven. Otherwise, I do think it undermines a lot of, as you said, the kind of the stance he's had, which is, hey, we're just fine. We just need to go out and execute more.
Yeah. I think that's the right take on that. I think what you do is you enter the game with set lines and then change it up on the fly,
yes,
right?
Just I agree, right? Just like
you may have to.
Yeah, because I think that's easier almost sometimes for players, right? It's like everyone's used to that. Like, lines get juggled, right? It happens. You respond to the game flow and you go from there rather than making it like a big talking point and changing things up going into the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's also the thing. Like, I do think the fundamental state of this series is that these teams are deadlocked. There is a stasis to the flow of play, and that stasis drags both teams toward, like, these games are so close that anything can happen, and these teams are so evenly matched that anything can happen. You know, the scoring chances, and I'm talking about like hand counted scoring chances per Dmitry, so we'll get into it with him.
Yep.
94-90 in the Canucks' favor through five games. Like, that is right there. And almost all of that margin came, like almost all of Vancouver's positive margin came when they had a chance to
at
Predators
the end of game
2-1 in game two.
Yeah.
a game that they trailed 2-0 or trailed by 2 for much of the proceedings, right? So, you know, there is no daylight. There is no daylight between these teams, which is why, you know, I do a thing every time I show up at the rink. I ask Harmon, what's your gut? And Harmon always hates it because he's like, I don't have feel for individual games. but I just make him tell me what he thinks will happen anyway, just as an exercise. And then I give, you know, my theory as well. I have no gut feel for tonight. Do you have a gut? What's your gut?
No, I don't. Like, it's so cliched and cop out, but like, it's going to be a tight, close game. That's my gut feeling.
Yeah, that's my gut. Here,
breaking
my gut
news.
Feeling is it's going to be a tight.
Yeah, earth-shattering analysis here. It's going to be tight. It's going to be tight out there, guys.
I think it's going to be a close game unless one of the teams has a decisive special teams advantage or one of the goalies really struggles. It's like, wow, yeah, great. That's every hockey game. That's all 1,300 hockey games we've seen played at the NHL level this season.
Not the ones involving the Sharks.
No, some other teams. True. I have gut feel for.
That's every playoff game, though, certainly, or at least most of them, right?
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. Fundamentally, like the Canucks, their goal prevention game's been on point, but they need something from a line that's not the Miller line at 5-on-5. I'd love to see Joshua and Garland play well. And then here's the last one. Like, I do think they're in trouble if this game looks like games 3 and 4, even though they won games 3 and 4, right? If this game looks like the games that have been played on Nashville ice to this point in the series, then the deck's going to be stacked against Vancouver and they're going to need the sort of good fortune that they had in both of those contests.
Well, I did want to ask you about that, right? Because even though the home team is 1 and 4 in this series, right? And yet when you look at it, the home team has also been the better team in pretty much every game, right? Depending on your value for game 2, but the teams have played better at home despite not consistently getting better results at home. Is that just, it's fundamentally easier to play in your own building than it is on the road? Are you seeing anything with the kind of matchup? It feels like we talked a lot about how the matchups play out, but then it hasn't really been before the series, but then it hasn't really been front and center once the series has gotten going, despite the home team enjoying an edge in play, if not results, throughout the course of the series.
Yeah, and I think it will be tonight. Like, I think that's changed as the series has gone along. We sort of had 3 games of stasis, and then in game 4 in Nashville, we started to see Brunette hunt the Pettersson matchup with Ryan O'Reilly. That was like the sort of first big change that we saw. And then we saw the Canucks figure out, by the way that Tocchet matched Brunette to start the periods, we saw Vancouver find a better flow in terms of really playing like the matchup game the way they wanted. So it was like strength on strength, first line versus first line, right? You still had a sort of a soft match on O'Reilly with the Lindholm line, but then they'd play against Miller. So, but effectively you had strength on strength at the top of the lineup, Pettersson against Sissons, and then fourth line against fourth line, in contrast with what we saw earlier in the series where Brunette was finding ways to punt that matchup and get McCarron out against the top line as much as possible. A move that ultimately I think actually did shape the series and that, Miller's line never really punished it. And the McCarron line, I think, got their licks in both on Vancouver's defense pair, but also on their forwards. And I actually think that's a matchup that Nashville prefers to Vancouver. In contrast with what we'd expect. Now that sort of the advantage tilts back to Brunette a little bit here with last change, I'll be curious to see, does he try to punt that matchup again in a do or die game? Does he try to hunt Pettersson versus O'Reilly head to head matchup as much as possible and count on the Sissons line to hold the fort against Lindholm and company? That's sort of going to be an interesting game within a game to monitor today is, you know, as this series has gotten deeper, we have seen these coaches begin to make some moves and counter moves in the margins. Does that shape tonight's contest in a significant way? My gut would be yes. My gut would be that we'll see a little bit more of that chess match tonight than we did earlier on in the series anyway.
Well, especially because the series has been so close, right? So you have to believe there's every incentive for the coaching staffs, but especially the home coaching staff, right, and Andrew Brunette to try, like, be as aggressive as possible to find whatever little edge they can in terms of being able to control the matchups, because there's just been so little to separate these teams throughout the course of the series. Now, Craig and Campbell River Texan, hey guys, respectfully disagree. The Canucks have been the second best team for the majority of this series, and if things are going to plan or close to it, according to Tocchet, then we have to question the instructions. It is not as if the Canucks are getting unlucky. They probably should have been eliminated or facing elimination by now. This is house money, but I don't trust the dealer. That's from Craig and Campbell River. And yeah, I don't know if Tocchet would necessarily say everything is going to according to plan, because he's also pointed out a lot of things the Canucks can do better and do differently. And he said, even again today, right, they've had periods, but they haven't been able to string together a whole stretch of game of what he would call Canucks hockey. I think what it comes down to for Tocchet is that their ability to play Canucks hockey should be in their control, rather than it's not necessarily that Nashville is preventing it. It's that the Canucks aren't stepping up to the plate and executing. And I think that's Tocchet's fundamental point of view, not that this is a level of play he's happy with from the Canucks. And, you know, to Craig's point, like, yeah, I mean, obviously the margins for the Canucks to build that 3-1 series lead were incredibly, incredibly fine. You think about game four, you think about the 12 seconds in game one. So, I wouldn't necessarily say that they should be eliminated or anything like that, but yeah, of course, this series could easily be 3-2 the other way in favor of Nashville.
Oh yeah, no, and I don't think they should be. I don't think it should have been a 5-game series win in Nashville's favor. That's no. I don't think that matches reality. But the fact is that only one team has managed to defeat the other by more than a goal in this series, and it's Nashville, right? Remove empty net goals, and the goal differential in this series is what, perfectly even? Right? Yep. I mean, pretty much. So, in fact, is even with empty netters removed. And I guess if you removed all 6-on-5, Nashville would have a slight edge. So, no, I mean, this is, I think, the problem with missing your shot in game five, despite leading with 13 minutes to go, is just that, like the betting odds actually factor this in. If you go look at Vancouver versus Nashville right now, the Predators are priced at +270 to win, which is an implied probability of exactly 25%. Well, what's 25%, right? It's not exactly, but it's like 24.7% or whatever. Round up, 25%. What's 25% represent here, Jamie?
Two coin flips, 50-50, right?
Two coin flips.
Yeah.
That's exactly
two 50,
right.
50-50 like chances.
Vegas is literally like, that number tells you that Vegas is looking at these teams as essentially equal.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the betting market handicaps this matchup now. And yeah, I mean, would Demko change that? Sure. Would if there was more confidence in Pedersen's level of play, would that be different? For sure. But where these teams sit right now with two games remaining, the markets think that this is not anyone's series, because they think in a 50-50, you know, whether the Canucks only have to win one, they get two chances. So that's 75%. But that's what we're seeing. That's how people are viewing this series. And I think they're right to. This is wafer thin, which makes tonight both nerve-wracking and underlines how important it is that Vancouver goes into this one with the chance to finish it off.
Canucks,
if heads comes up or tails.
Canucks playoff coverage on Sportsnet 650 brought to you by All Seasons Roofing. Sun, rain, wind, or snow, All Seasons Roofing has you covered with end-to-end roofing services. For your free quote, visit allseasonsroofing.ca. Dmitry Filipovich going to join us, as always, for the last segment on a Friday. We'll get his thoughts on everything that's unfolded since the last time we chatted with him in this series. That's up next. Dmitry Filipovich here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Applewood Mitsubishi. With Mitsubishi's 10-year, 160,000-kilometer lithium-ion battery warranty, the battery may be the last thing you worry about. Details at Applewood Mitsubishi in the Richmond Auto Mall. Now joining us here live in the Kintec studio, as he does every week. You'll hear him on the Hockey PDOcast here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. He is Dmitry Filipovich. What's going on, Dmitry?
Fellas, what's going on? Happy Friday. Happy hours before Game 6.
That's right. 2.5 hours before Game 6 here. It's very exciting. So last week, we sat here after the first two games in between Nashville and the Canucks, and we said, you know, surely this series is going to get more high event at some point. And if anything, it's gone the other way since then. The Canucks are, like, setting records for fewest shots on goal through five games, or certainly through four games in a playoff series. What has stood out to you in the ensuing three games since we last chatted here?
Yeah, what are they averaging? About 18 or so shots per game. I will say, I was talking about this on my show today, and people will hear it when it comes out, but I think this playoff so far is kind of showing us that teams are moving away from really caring at all about actual shot attempts and shots on goal, and so heavily prioritizing scoring chances. And maybe that's been the case for certain organizations for a while, but we're seeing nearly every team this postseason adopted. Like, the Canucks are obviously on the utmost extreme here at under 20 shots per game, but you're seeing a lot of other teams mixing in games where they're getting around 19, 20, 21, 22 shots on goal. And so in this series, especially as it's gone along, I do think Game 5 was a great example. The first period was a slog for both teams, but as it opened up in the second period, they really each started to kind of trade chances back and forth, and I thought it made for a pretty entertaining product. So I'm not sure that the shot on goal total, even though it seems extremely low event, is necessarily indicative of like how these games have gone on.
So it's basically what you're describing there, a conscious effort to, we're going to hold the puck unless it's a grade A scoring chance, right? Or at least not hold the puck unless, but turn the dial a little bit more to, we're going to be more selective until we get to those dangerous areas.
Well, both of these teams are essentially playing Barry Trotz hockey from the Islanders teams that made the Eastern Conference final in back-to-back years, where they were a really like early adopter of this. This is taking it to an extreme, as I said. But yeah, you see the Canucks strategy in Game 5 in particular, and they were shooting so much for like tips and stuff very deliberately. And a lot of those don't actually wind up making it on net or counting as shots on goal, and so you don't get credit for any sort of event. But I would argue that that is the right play. Like, generally, Carson Soucy shooting from the point is not going to beat UC Saros cleanly, but if he's shooting for JT Miller's stick in the slot and he's able to redirect it cleanly, that probably will beat UC Saros. And so when it doesn't work out, it doesn't look the best, but I think it's like the process of it is very sound.
Damn it. The point about Game 5 being a more entertaining product, is that not advantage Nashville?
Yeah. I think it is. I mean, you can certainly see it, particularly in the third period, Nashville was clearly pushing, right? They were on the brink of elimination, so they had the more motivated stance. But you could see Ryan McDonagh was living below the dots in the offensive zone that entire third period, and he got two or three grade A scoring chances, didn't wind up converting on them. Then eventually, Roman Josi takes it to the net on the power play, and they score off of that. I think that was clearly by design. I'm very curious to see if Nashville's able to enter Game 6 with that sort of attacking mindset right from the jump, as opposed to waiting till the final period of their season to do so. And I think that'll be very telling on how this game plays out. But yeah, they put that on tape. I don't think it's necessarily a surprise because they did that most of the regular season. But I think that's also a credit to this Canucks team that they've been able to kind of bottle it up and sort of Jedi mind trick them in a way into not playing that way for a lot of this series. So yeah, I think that's something to watch for right when the puck drops in Game 6.
The fundamental dynamic of this series really has been how close it is, right? 4-1 goal games, excluding empty netters, and, you know, only one victory that was clear from either team. And honestly, the game that Vancouver lost by multiple goals was probably their best performance of the series. What does that mean to you as we get to the end game of this first round?
Yeah, I mean, it's so tight. It's almost like a playoff series. I mean, this is playoff hockey, right? And I think for better or for worse, like, depending on your perspective on it and sort of how much anxiety it induces, like, it's really fun and entertaining. Also, it can be immensely stressful and sometimes almost nauseating because you're like, oh God, like, I don't know if this is going to be a meritocracy because a random puck bounce here or there or a bad call by an official could swing not only this game, but this series.
Yep.
And so I don't know what your mileage is on that in terms of whether that's a good or bad thing, but that ultimately is like playoff hockey at its nucleus.
Yeah, and somebody texted in, like, I used to just be so stressed about whether the Canucks would turn things around when they were bad, and now I'm just so stressed about whether or not they'll win this playoff.
Well, you always want what you can't have,
the
right?
Inherent fan experience, right, is being super stressed about your team. To your point about Ryan McDonagh in particular, you know, really getting active in the offensive zone, getting below the dots, you know, he had that one glorious scoring chance on the rebound that ends up missing the net. Nashville does some things that are so aggressive, right? Whether it's activating that defender in the offensive zone, but also when they get the puck and are transitioning and they've like somehow already got a guy or two at the blue line before you even know it. What do they do to prevent getting burned, you know, on the flip side of that aggression? Or is it that the Canucks are kind of, because they're not necessarily like a rush team, are they kind of ill-equipped to burn Nashville when they're being aggressive like that?
Yeah, in the regular season, they would certainly get burned and they would just bank on UC Saros making the saves when he needed to. And that's kind of a luxury you have when UC Saros is your goalie. I think in this series, it's interesting because I think they're almost banking on the fact that the Canucks, and they, you know, they've shown they're so disciplined that they're not going to fall for that trap. Like, I think Nashville ultimately wouldn't mind giving the Canucks a few two-on-ones or odd-man rushes, because then that would speed the game up and get the Canucks pulling them out of their preferred pace and environment and element, right? And so it's kind of been that power struggle, seeing whether they can get them into that game. The Canucks have resisted very firmly for pretty much the entirety of the series. So, yeah, we'll see if that continues. I did think that, you know, bringing in Tyson Barrie really opened things up for Nashville. You could see just like his ability to extend plays, move the puck. It really changed the dynamic for them. And so it sounds like he will be in for game six yet again, right? And so I think that's like a really big change for them.
Well, from game one, they brought in Dante Fabbro and Tyson Barrie, right? So two changes on the blue line for them and two kind of puck moving profiling players coming in to the lineup. And, you know, it's an interesting point you make about the rush style just inherently favoring Nashville. I think there's been like maybe a total of like 10 minutes total in the series where it's really opened up. And in those stretches, it has definitely looked like Nashville's been enjoying it more than the Canucks and Rick Tocchet have been in those moments. In terms of, you know, the Canucks and what they need to do better, I mean, so much focus on Elias Pettersson, but also the Lindholm, Garland, Joshua line. They've had some big goals, but they haven't created scoring chances at the same rate that they were in the regular season when Teddy Bluger was in the middle of that line. What can they do differently to spend a little bit more time in Nashville's zone?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, they're going to be relied upon pretty heavily. I thought, for the most part, I like their game in game five. They certainly had a few chances. I think, funny enough, Garland had one of those two-on-ones, and I don't think he even got a shot off on it. I think he might have like kind of tried to pass it into a sliding defender. I forget what the outcome was, but it didn't wind up leading to a goal. He had that play behind the net where he passed it out to Lindholm, and Saros, I think, showed that he's probably one of the only goalies in the world that could have made that save, because he covered... I think he covered the entire surface of the rink from east to west during that sequence where he was just sliding across on his knees. And so it was a great save. But those are the types of plays, right? Work the puck behind the net, work that cycle, and then get it out for those high danger chances, similar to Lindholm's game-winning goal in game four. So, yeah, I mean, that's the formula. It's just a matter of executing now.
Dim, there's sort of two types of series that we sometimes get as we get into, like, game six and game seven. And one is where a team breaks the other team. You know what I mean? And it's like, sometimes those series even go longer than you expect, but you can sort of sniff out that a team is fading, gaining a massive advantage. Usually it involves like playing guys out of the lineup, stuff like that. And I don't have that sense about this series. Like, I think what we've seen to this point is going to govern game six, and if necessary, game seven, in that it's just going to be like, tight checking, space and time at a premium, and if the Canucks are going to advance here, they're going to just need like heads or tails to come up on this weighted coin flip one of two times. Do you have a different read on what to expect tonight and on Sunday should it occur?
No, I think that's right. I think anyone that watched Leafs Bruins game six, for example, last night, that first period, if you think this series has been ugly, go back and watch that first period where both teams were handling the puck like a grenade, and essentially the entirety of the period was spent in the neutral zone. And I think that's kind of what you see in some of these games six and seven, where the pressure gets ramped up, neither team wants to make a mistake, and so you default to kind of like the most conservative playing style and just trying not to make mistakes. And I'd argue that that kind of favors this Canucks team with the way they play, because not only will that kind of slow down the events and make more of the game spent in the neutral zone. But they're willing, I think, more so to embrace kind of the chaotic nature of like a bouncing puck just all over the ice and not necessarily trying to make high skill plays going north-south off the rush. Whereas the Predators, once you get that extra pressure, you start making some uncharacteristic mistakes. You really feel it and see it there. So yeah, if the Canucks team can just kind of get the puck deep, forecheck the Predators defense, and then benefit off of those mistakes they make, that's kind of the formula for these games, for every playoff game really, but I think particularly once you get into the latter stages of the series.
With what we're seeing from Vancouver, like their practice yesterday was all power play. Aside from like some basic drills to get everyone into the flow. What do you make of that? And what have you made of the special teams matchup in this series to this point?
Yeah, I think you and I spoke on my show after game three, right? Some of the adjustments the team made and how that benefited them in that game and was ultimately the difference in it. I mean, it's going to come down to this. What the goals at 5-on-5 in the series so far, I believe, are 7-7 through five games for both teams. So I think that's an acknowledgement that you're probably not scoring more than one or two goals tops at even strength in this game. And then it is going to come down to essentially which team I think can score one or two goals on the man advantage. And so it makes sense that that would be a primary focus. And that's just ultimately, I think, like, this is going to be a coin flip game, and it's going to come down to, I think, which team can score a power play goal and which team can't.
All right. So awaiting the winner of this series, of course, is the Edmonton Oilers, who took care of the Kings. Now, rather than getting ahead of ourselves and asking you about how the Canucks match up with Edmonton, because we've got a while to go before that, who do you think Edmonton is cheering for in this series as they await to see who they're going to play in round two? Who would they rather face?
I think they'd probably rather face Nashville, just because I think that would lend itself to a more fast-paced, high-scoring environment, and they would probably, I think, just enjoy playing in that a bit more. I think that's going to be a lot of Edmonton 7-5 victories, and it might be a short series, but a highly entertaining, high-scoring one. I think the Canucks have shown that they probably will be able to kind of drag Edmonton into the mud with them, so to speak, in a series like this, and so Edmonton played that way in the later stages of that Kings round one series, and I think they sort of have shown that they're able to do that, and I'm sure they pride themselves on making that evolution as a team. But I still think ultimately they would much rather default to a fun, high-scoring environment, which I think a Nashville as a round two opponent would provide them with.
And just quickly on LA, you know, we talked to Shayna Goldman on the show yesterday, and she said, like, not only have they lost three times in a row to Edmonton, but this was like the least competitive version of that series from LA's perspective, which is just such a tough feeling. Going up against the same foe in 3 years and feeling like you're losing ground on them rather than gaining. What do they do now? Like, they made the big swing, they made the big investment in Pierre-Luc Dubois. They're, as I said, losing ground against one of the top teams in the division. It seems like they've got a really, really difficult summer coming up.
Yeah, that was a miserable series from a Kings perspective. Watching it, even the game four where I believe they got shut out 1-0, and the shots on goal were like 33-12 for LA, and everyone was like, oh, they really threw the kitchen sink at Edmonton here. They gave them their best shot. It's like, did they? I think they had like five scoring chances the entire game. Everything was from the perimeter, from bad angles, kind of just desperation plays. And that was our biggest concern about the Kings all season. It was regardless of what their possession metrics were like, regardless of how fast-paced they were playing, they weren't able to get into the inside. They weren't creating scoring chances. And in particular, after a coaching change, they almost went in the entirely wrong direction. So it's kind of back to the drawing board, except from a significantly worse position because they have way less assets, way less flexibility, and they're kind of stuck almost with this team, barring some sort of miraculous trade that they are able to pull out, and I don't see that happening. So I think they just have to nail a coaching hire. Like, I think they need to bring in, honestly, an Andrew Brunette type, like Nashville did this past offseason, to try and generate some sort of offense from this team, because the personnel should be much better than they gotten results out of. But yeah, they just can't keep going down the same road.
Dim, what do you make of the first round in general? Like, it hasn't been the most thrilling. In some ways, it hasn't been the most evenly matched. I know there was a sense of, like, a wide-open field coming into the playoffs, and yet you kind of watch this first round, and it feels like maybe that was, like, a false hope, and that, in fact, this is as stratified as it has been for much of the last 5 years between the clear contenders and sort of the pretender tier teams. Do you get that sense watching this first round too?
Yeah, certainly. I think on paper there were a couple of mismatches. I think we were deprived of a really fun series between Colorado and Winnipeg, because Colorado just put the boots to Winnipeg and they had no adjustments and just them. Essentially yep. just let them do whatever they wanted. And so I think that removed one of the fun matchups off the board. The other ones have kind of been chalk for the most part. I guess Dallas Vegas is giving us a potential 7-game series, and that one has been really fun with Dallas bouncing back. It has been a bit disappointing from like an entertainment and drama perspective. At the same time, we might get a few game sevens here, and I think it is shaping up to be a really fun second round.
We get the ultimate haters game seven between the
you
the
can't
Leafs
lose. You
Boston.
Can't. You yeah. really can't. If you're not a fan of either of those teams, you can't lose because someone will be miserable and you will enjoy it.
Whoever loses, we win, and that's the key takeaway from that series. For me, you mentioned Vegas, Dallas, and I know Drance is saying like you're probably betting on Dallas to finish it off tonight.
No, Tom doesn't bet. Tom doesn't bet on.
Oh, it doesn't bet, but you know what I mean. You're picking Dallas to finish it off tonight. Okay, Drance is staring blankly at us. He might not be able to hear us there.
Oh, he looks very...
Sorry, am I?
Yeah, I thought that was a question for Dan. No, I was bringing you into the conversation.
Oh, sorry, yes. Dallas is taking care of business tonight.
I was like...
You know I love my Stars.
I was going to say, I thought you would jump at the opportunity
to
tout your Stars a
little bit. Tom has famously been high on the Stars all season.
Hey, in fairness, I recognized it relatively early once Stankoven came in. I was like, okay, this is different now. This team is different now. Plus the Harley thing. That was, an untold, or not like, I mean, we focus on it a lot, Dimitri, but yep. the elevating Harley to play with Heiskanen just opened up a whole new world for that team. They are, they're winning tonight, and then they're going to beat the Avalanche. No question about it. They're down to 7-1 to win the cup.
You on the same page on
Which
the Stars?
I don't find frustrating.
I do think they're going to win. I'm not necessarily that confident they're going to win tonight, just because winning 4 in a row against Vegas does seem very tough. But games 3 and 5, they really dominated Vegas and exposed a lot of their issues with their team speed and just really created a lot off the rush. So, yeah, if they're able to channel that again, it could be a wrap for Vegas. And that'll be very satisfying because I feel like we were very high on Dallas all the way, but then particularly entering this series where we're kind of like dismissive of Vegas in a way. And then after the first two games played out, I was like, I was yanking on my collar. Yes. Like, this is going to be a tough way to save face. But
I think we didn't do like go through the whole thing and pick our Stanley Cup winners. If we had, mine would have been Dallas.
Yeah.
I'm glad we didn't put all of
that. Yeah. I did a bracket. I think I did Dallas over Florida, which I think was probably a pretty common pick.
Sure.
And that made me worried that that's probably not going to happen because it never really goes to form in that way. But yeah, them getting potentially swept based on the first two games would have been, I might have to retire. I don't know if I would have been able to come back into the office the next day after that. So I'm glad that didn't work out, and I'm glad that Dallas is back on track.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. We got to do a draft here to wrap up the week ahead of game six between Dallas and game six between Dallas and Vegas is happening.
You're on Dallas talk.
Game six between between the Canucks and the Preds in just hours.
I've got a draft idea.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
So there are... we've had 5 teams advance, and there's 3 first-round series still going. So that means that gives us a sample of 11 teams. Let's go 3 rounds and draft long shot odds to win the Stanley Cup.
All right.
Do you think about that?
Okay.
I'll send.
What do you, mean by
both
drafting
so that you
long shot odds though? So like, how are we judging the criteria here? What are our picks based on? Who we think is going to win the Stanley
Cup?
Like
value on the odds, right? Is what you're talking about?
Yeah, the value on the odds, the bets you most want to make.
Okay.
All right.
So I'm sending you both the odds, and then I will defer.
I think you should make the first pick while we look at the odds, because you know what they are.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably
good. I'll defer to you guys.
You should definitely make the first pick.
You should make the first 3 picks.
Okay, I'll make the first pick. Dallas, +700.
here on Star Stock.
I am absolutely stunned, that you would go Dallas +700.
I would have liked it even more at 25-1 last week.
I don't think this is going to happen, but I'll take Vegas Golden Knights at 45-1. Just because 45-1 on the defending Stanley Cup champion, I know they're down 3-2. I'll take it. That's a nice long shot. They have this on play now.
That's a good pick.
They have the second longest odds behind only Nashville. Nashville's at 6,600. Yeah. Vegas is at 4,500, +4,500.
That's a good pick. I take the Panthers here at +475. I know that they're the second favorite, but I just think that regardless of who comes out of that Boston-Toronto series, they're going to be heavily favored and are set up to really just clean up on them. And then they're already in the East Final, so they just have to win two more series after that, whereas a lot of these other teams are kind of coin flips in round two. So give me Florida.
You get another one, Tim.
Oh, I get another one.
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna go back to the well. Oilers are also +475. Same odds, same logic. With all apologies to all our listeners here, I think they're going to be heavily favored in round two. And so I like that more than Dallas and Colorado, for example, who are going to have to play each other. And that seems like a very miserable series. So I will go with Edmonton.
Edmonton is absolutely going to be heavily favored in round two. They must be just I've said this a couple times on the show. They must be loving how the bracket is setting up for them so far in this Stanley Cup playoffs. All right. I already have Vegas. Whew, this is tricky here. I'm going to go with the New York Rangers at +750. Look, I'm going to be picking Carolina to beat New York, so already don't love the pick, but I'm trying to find that value. So I'll take the New York Rangers, President's Trophy winners, lots of star power at +750.
I will say, I don't think the odds between the Rangers at +750 and the Hurricanes at 400 should be
that big,
that skewed. Like, I know the Dom releases odds and they're pretty heavily favored, the Hurricanes are, but I think it's much more of a coin flip. So I think they should be much more even than that.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, the Hurricanes are basically valued as favored as heavily as the Canucks were against the Predators. So I've got two picks here, and I'm going to take Colorado and Carolina. So both are like +400 or +550. So shorter odds, both favorites, but I got to snap up the remaining favorites, giving me Dallas, Carolina, and Colorado. I won the draft for once.
All right. I guess I will take – I mean, I'll go with the Canucks. +2200. Why not? Hey, they're on the verge of winning their first round series. I'll go with the Vancouver Canucks at +2200.
I'm going to push back on Tom. There's no way you won the draft because one of your teams is going to get eliminated automatically in round two, diminishing your odds. Whereas I have Edmonton and Florida, who are heavy favorites to make the final in both of their conferences. I'll go with the Boston Bruins, I guess, +1500, home ice in game seven, and then they'll enter a series where they're going to be underdogs. But crazier things can happen.
So we drafted everyone except the Leafs and the Preds. Those are the only two teams that got. I did consider doing the ultimate emotional hedge and taking the Leafs at +2500.
Honestly, the Leafs are much, based on the odd discrepancy, the Leafs are probably a better pick than the Bruins just based on that.
So. Well, there you go. All right, that's Canucks talk for today. Remember, Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah on Canucks Central will be coming up here. Canucks playoff coverage on Sportsnet 650 is brought to you by All Seasons Roofing. Sun, rain, wind, or snow, All Seasons Roofing has you covered with end-to-end roofing services. For your free quote, visit allseasonsroofing.ca. Game 6 in just a couple of hours. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.